I'm Lincoln, I'm an alcoholic. And first I just want to thank Billy for inviting me down here to speak. And my sobriety date is July 21st, 2003. As mentioned, I do have a sponsor, and I have the privilege to sponsor some other guys in this program. My home group is the Outlaw Safecracker Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we meet in Richmond Monday nights at 8 o'clock. We have a speaker meeting, and on Thursday nights we have a big book discussion. And if you guys are, any of you ever in Richmond, I would love to see you come out to our group. We've got a really active home group, and I love that group. We do a lot of service. We try to carry the message in a lot of different ways. We record our speakers, make those available to people. We carry a meeting to the psychiatric ward in Richmond, and it's just a great group, and I'm really lucky to be a part of that. We have some things in common with your group. We have a very structured meeting, and I think when I first got here, if I'd heard that kind of announcement at the beginning, I would have probably got a little tense and a little nervous. But now, that kind of thing just makes me happy, man. It just warms my heart when I hear an announcement that, you know, just stay in your seats. When I chair my own group, my favorite part of the meeting is when I get to that point when I get to make an announcement that just tell people to stay in their seats and coffee will be served after the Lord's Prayer. But it's for a purpose. It's because, you know, our job in these meetings is to be able to carry a message to the newcomer. And I know when I first got here, I was often that guy getting up and being distracting and whatnot. So I just really appreciate your meeting, and again, just really glad you've asked me to come out. You know, I want to try to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I grew up, well, I was born in Williamsburg, Virginia, and my mother is a recovered alcoholic. She was getting sober when I was really young. My mother and father divorced when I was really young, and we moved around a fair amount. My father was from Connecticut, and we moved back and forth a couple times between Williamsburg and Connecticut. For the most part, grew up in Williamsburg, but we would move to back to Connecticut, and I would start in a new school, and I'd show up in the middle of the school year in a class where everybody seemed to know each other, everybody seemed to know what was going on, and I just felt like something was missing as far as I just didn't know, like I'd been left out of some kind of secret or something like that. Everybody kind of knew what to do, and I don't know, I would often spend a lot of my time just kind of in my own world, you know, and I would run into guys, like I ran into a guy, I mean, I'm like in second grade, and one of my friends at the time just asked me, hey, well, do you want a candy bar? And I said, well, I don't have any money. He said, that's all right. You know, so we go to the store, and he shows me how to steal, you know. And so that was just kind of my approach to a lot of suggestions was, hey, do you want to do this? Okay, sure. You know, and do you want a candy bar? Okay, sure. And so that meant I'm just going to steal it. And we got into stealing quite a bit of stuff, you know. In second grade was the first time that the state troopers showed up at my house looking for me for breaking the law. And we had been stealing a lot from hardware stores. We had a lot of the other guys in the neighborhood kind of in on it, and people looking out and, you know, distracting the clerks while we could be over here stealing something else. And, you know, my mom is, you know, new in AA and trying to get sober, and so she's thinking, these guys have got to make amends. You know, they've got to pay for this. And so we went to work at this place called the Washington Supply Company. We're hauling timber out in the sun, and we were young, but they worked us, man. They worked us hard, and, you know, I guess to the best of our ability at the time, you know, we cleaned up that mess. But, you know, I mentioned that a little bit because, you know, before I had my first drink, I'm stealing, you know. And I was certainly lying before I had my first drink, you know. I told lies to people when the truth would have been more convenient. I don't remember what grade, maybe third or fourth grade, I'd overheard some teachers talking about CB radios, you know, that were popular at the time. And they were talking about their handles, their code names or whatever, and I didn't know what that was. And I got in on this conversation, and I asked them what was a handle. They said, well, hot chocolate or bumblebee or something like that. And I said, oh, yeah, my mom's got a CB. You know, because I just wanted to be a part of that group, and we did not have CB radio, you know, but I just said, yeah, we do. And they said, well, really, what's your handle? And hot chocolate. Yeah, that's it, you know. And, I mean, they must have been looking at me like, I mean, it must have been very obvious. I'm just making this stuff up. But, you know, again, they're at the very beginning of my life, on some level, something was missing with me. You know, I've come to understand what I think that is, you know, is the spiritual malady. You know, I have a spiritual deficit. I'm looking for something. I'm lying to you because I think that if you accept me, then maybe I can connect with you. And I'm stealing to get things that because I think that if I have this thing, well, then, you know, maybe I'll feel complete and whole as a person. And, you know, a lot of behavior was present like that before I took my first drink. I would cheat in school. I was a liar and a cheat and a thief is the simplest way to put it. I could get into a lot of specific stories, but that's the gist of it, you know. At some point, somebody offered me some alcohol. You know, I do remember my first drink. My first drink wasn't really my first drunk. But I had been warned of alcohol. My mom is a recovering alcoholic at this point, and there was no alcohol in our house. And I had a pretty healthy fear of alcohol. But at some point, it was offered to me, and do you want a drink? Sure, why not? You know, and so I did, and I think I was just too afraid to really get into it at that time. But at some point, we'd find these guys to buy us alcohol. It was probably like 16, and we'd go to this one guy who would buy us these Sun Country wine coolers in the big 2-liter bottle, and me and my buddies would get one of these each and just go out in the woods and drink them, you know. And that's where some stuff started happening for me. I had found my solution, you know. Basically, if I really believe that my problem is this spiritual malady, this spiritual deficit where I'm lacking something in here, and I don't know how to feel like I connect with you, and then all of a sudden I find, and granted, I've tried a lot of other things up in this point, you know. I thought if I had a cool car, I thought if I had a good-looking girlfriend, and I thought if I had all these things, then I would, at some level, just feel normal. And then I found alcohol. And I realized, okay, now I've found something that really works. Because now I feel complete. You know, I don't feel... I feel part of. I feel connected with people. You know, when I'm drinking with my friends, you know, there was just nothing like that feeling of... just feeling connected and a part of the group finally, you know. And, you know, of course, at a certain point, you know, the alcohol starts doing some things to me that start creating some new problems, you know. I mean, I'm underage, so I'm not allowed to be drinking. My mom's a recovering alcoholic. She certainly doesn't want me to be drinking. And so I'm hiding all this, and I mean, I was young, so I mean, I think I had a part-time job, and I didn't really have any money, and so we're stealing a lot of alcohol, and we're out driving around, and just doing all the stuff that we do when we're young, and drinking, and, you know, some of my first consequences with drinking were getting a drunk in public, you know, and, so the alcohol is starting to bring me some of these consequences. But when you're underage, it's just really not that big of a deal in the eyes of the law. They just call your parents, send you home, and that's that. At that point, alcohol was just too good to even think about it being a problem or giving it up. You know, I had people starting to suggest that maybe you you might want to lay off that a little bit. And nothing that anybody ever said to me at that point made any kind of difference to me at all. I was thoroughly convinced that I had found something that was going to be a part of my life forever, you know. And, you know, my sponsor pointed out something to me that, I'll use his example, that if you gave my grandmother, who is not an alcoholic, the amount of alcohol that I was drinking, she would get drunk and do some crazy, absurd stuff, you know. But that doesn't necessarily make her an alcoholic. You know, the amount that I was drinking, of course, yes, I am doing some very humiliating things, some very hurtful things, I'm breaking the law and all of that. That doesn't necessarily, that still wasn't necessarily my problem. You know, my problem is that I've got this spiritual malady, and at some point, I'm not really explaining that too clearly, but at some point, this newfound solution, alcohol, my relationship to it changes, you know. I go through high school, and my friends are doing things like applying to college and moving on with their life, and I wasn't doing any of that stuff, you know. And they all went off to school, and I found myself still in Williamsburg, and just looking for a new group of friends, and I just found guys that were in the same situation as me, guys that liked to drink like I drink, guys that weren't going to give me a problem, you know, about the way I drank, you know, and things were starting to happen, you know, that I would realize that when I started drinking, I can't really stop drinking, you know, and it took me a long time to see that, because I'm hanging out with people that drink like I do, you know, and we all drank until the point where we passed out or ran out or got arrested or locked up or something like that. But, you know, at some point I was trying to kind of move my life into a direction that that made sense to me. And, you know, I did eventually go to college, and, you know, I have all these 8 o'clock classes that I just can't make, because when I start drinking, I'm up so late, and I'm drinking to the point where I'm blacking out, and the only thing I can think of to change is to start drinking earlier, you know, because once I start drinking, I'm going to drink for 8-10 hours maybe, so I just need to start drinking earlier, and that wouldn't work. And so then I would think, well, maybe I just need to drink on just the weekends, you know, and that way I can go to my classes, that way I'll go to work and things will be okay. And but then, you know, Sunday would, you know, there'd be football games on, and, you know, well, I got to drink Sunday, and then there'd be Monday night football. Like, well, I'll drink Monday, but I won't drink Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. But then sometimes, you know, there might be something going on Thursday, and Thursday's pretty close to the weekend, you know. And so it became really hard for me just to drink on the weekends. But, you know, I'm trying to control it unsuccessfully, and I'm becoming aware that other people don't seem to be having some of these problems I'm having with alcohol. They can watch football, drink some beers, and go home. They go to work. They meet their responsibilities, you know. I'm the one that's begging everybody else to go out after the game and go do these other things. Other people are able to just drink on the weekends. And, you know, so I'm experiencing some trouble in controlling my drinking, you know. And then, you know, I might do something that tells me, you know, I just need to quit drinking altogether. Can't control it. I just need to just put it out of my life. And so I quit for a couple days, maybe a week, and I wouldn't be able to stay quit, you know. You know, I didn't want to get too much into all the war stories, but, you know, some of the stuff that would happen would, you know, I was dating this girl, and, you know, I cared about her a lot, and she cared about me, and, there was a situation where, you know, I was working at a restaurant at the time, and we drank a lot. You know, we'd work at night and get off our shift and go to the bar and drink and whatever. And we made it home, my friend and I, made it home, and by the time we got back, you know, my girlfriend wasn't there, and we were wondering where she was. Well, she had to go to the hospital. She had a situation, and she had to go to the hospital. And so we rush over there, and I mean, I am hammered at this point. And but we go to the hospital, and you know, I'm worried sick. I spend the night in the hospital, and she has to stay there for a couple days. So, you know, the next day I go to work, and I'm telling myself things like, I'm not drinking tonight, so I got to go visit her, man. You know, and she's up there alone and worried and all this, and you know, I definitely can't drink tonight. I got to do that. And so I work my shift, and then by the end of the night, I have a thought that, well, maybe I'll just have a couple beers real quick, and then I'll go over to the hospital and see her. You know, and I have a couple beers. You know, and I understand now what's happening to me. I didn't understand it at the time. You know, what's happening to me at the time makes total sense. That I'm going to just have a couple beers, and then, well, you know, I mean, it's kind of late, and they probably don't want me to go visit there this late at night because the visitation is, you know, I'll probably just get in their way. And so she, you know, next thing you know, the phone's ringing, you know, and it's her from her hospital room. You know, are you going to come by and see me tonight, or what are you doing? And then I got to explain it to her, you know, because she doesn't know. She doesn't realize that, you know, the visiting hours are probably over, and I'm just going to get in the way, and you're probably tired anyway, and, you know, I'm just probably better for me just to stay here, you know. And she's in tears on the other end of the line, you know, and I'm just doing what I've got to do, man, because I can't just stop drinking once I've started. You know, I've got a job to do, and you know, that's just a small example of how I hurt the people that I love, you know. I don't set out to hurt these people. And you know, and then the next day when I tell her, I am definitely going to come see you tonight. I swear to God, I'll be there tonight. You know, I don't know what I was thinking last night. That was crazy. But I will be there tonight. And it's the truth. I'm not lying to her. You know, I'm telling her what I truly believe. And I feel horrible for what I've done. I feel completely ashamed of my behavior, you know. But then the next night, that thought pops into my head again. Well, I won't do what I did last night, but maybe I'll just have a beer tonight. And then, you know, it happens all over again. And it's just like in the book, or I'm pounding my fist on the bar, like, how did this happen again? You know, and so, you know, I'm hurting these people. And I mean, I could really go on forever to the degree of pain that I caused, you know, with people I loved and, you know, my mom, good God, you know, the amount of torture I put her through. I mean, especially the fact that she was sober and she could see what was going on with me and know that she was unable to say anything to do me any good. You know, she would tell me how fearful she was every time the phone rang at night, because she thought for sure that it was going to be a police officer telling her that they found my body in some ditch, or I've overdosed, or I've done something. And she had to live in fear because she knows what I've got, you know. And no amount of begging or pleading by any of these people was going to be anywhere near sufficient for me to change. It just took a lot of pain. It just took what it took for me to get to a point where, you know, I could ask somebody for some help. And, you know, it would just be years before that would happen, you know. And I would try all kinds of different ways to control my drinking, and it just didn't work. But I guess the good news there is that I knew what AA was, and that's also kind of the bad news, because I knew already what AA was, you know, and I knew where to go, and I'd seen AA work in the lives of people that were close to me, and I reached that point where I was so scared to keep on going, drinking the way I was. But in the same thought, in the same moment, I was so terrified to think about what life would be like without alcohol, you know. I couldn't conceive of it, you know. All I had been living was this life that made sense to me, as crazy as it was, you know. Landlords evicting me and checks bouncing all over town. living in blackouts, going to work where people knew more about what I had done the night before than I had done, and I had to be really good at improvising when I saw them. Hey, man, you know what you did last night? Like, yeah, I did. Well, you know, maybe try to get some information out of them without letting on that that I had no idea. You know, I'm living with that level of shame and fear and terror myself, you know. But that's the only life that ever made sense to me. It's the only life I ever knew. So to imagine going on like that was just terrifying. But really the idea of going on without alcohol was just inconceivable. The only thing good about it was that I knew some people who had done it. And I started seeing something in them that was really attractive. You know, my mom had always been sober, so I didn't really get to see her life change. I just knew a sober person in my mom. But, you know, as a teenager and in my 20s and whatnot, I didn't see her as, that wasn't something attractive. It was just kind of, wow, what a really boring life, you know, and I didn't want any part of it, you know, but my brother and I, we drank together, you know, we shared a lot of the same friends, we went to the same bars, we did a lot of stuff together, and he had gotten sober a couple months before I'd reached this point where I was kind of thrown in the towel, and in a very short period of time, I saw some changes in him that were attractive, you know. And it was just little stuff that that meant a lot to me at the time. You know, he showed up and he had a new shirt on one day. It was something that simple, like, wow, you know, hey man, your life's looking pretty good. You know, you're looking a lot better. Well, and you know, he was looking better. You know, he had a little color in his skin. You know, he had filled out a little bit more. Well, and he wasn't just falling down all the time. You know, and you know, he didn't have cuts on his face and stuff. You know, I could tell something was changing in him. And, you know, we knew probably every cab driver in Richmond by first name. And he all of a sudden has a car and he's driving and he has a license and he has insurance and it's inspected all at the same time. And those are things that I don't really know anything about, you know, in my life. Yeah, I mean, I could have had any one of those things at one time, but the whole package, man, that was impressive. And he was talking about, you know, he's getting a new computer. So, I mean, I'm seeing some of this outside stuff and perceiving some of the inside stuff, but it was enough because I was so freaking miserable, you know, that I could latch on to that. And so one morning after a really, really long night, I called him up and I just told him everything was going on. And and he came over, like, right away. Just came over. And, you know, this guy's got 3-4 months sober. And I don't know if it was just that he's my brother and he loves me, or if it was if anybody had showed him what to do, if it was just intuitive. But all he did was what it tells us to do in the book. He just came over and listened to me, and then he told me what he was doing right now, you know. He told me that he was going to some meetings, you know. He told me some of the stuff he had heard at meetings, and, you know, I was still scared, but I was interested and desperate enough that I had a little bit of willingness, you know. And at this point, he was really sounding a lot different. He had kind of his own language. He'd call me up in the morning and say, "Hey, man, how about a little early morning serenity?" You know, I'm like, "Who are you? What are you? What has happened to you?" And I didn't really know what that meant. And it was early, man. It was like 9 o'clock in the morning. And he picked me up in his car, you know, and take me to a meeting. At the time, you know, I'm riding around my girlfriend's pink bike that's got maybe 3 or 4 gears that actually work, and I'd gotten a flat tire like that day, and he picks me up and we go to this meeting. He's like, I was like, "I can't go to the meeting. I've got to take care of my bike, man." You know, he's like, "Go to the meeting first. Bike will take care of itself." I'm like, "All right." We go to the meeting, and he's like, "All right, let's see about this." You know, he takes me to the bike shop, and I pull out my wallet. I got like exactly like $7 in there. He's like, see? You know, the inner tube's like 650. He's like, see? You know how this works, you know? And I mean, that's stuff. Those are some fond memories now. But some of those principles are very true, man. I take care of my alcoholism first. You know, the only way for me to have a good life in all areas of my life is when I take care of my alcoholism first. And I don't know. That those were some good times, you know. But at any rate, you know, it got me here. You know, it got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was following suggestions, and it made it really easy for me to follow suggestions. You know, he had a sponsor, and I figured, well, hey, I guess I need to get a sponsor too. And that's where it really started, was with my first sponsor. You know, my first sponsor was one of the first guys that approached me at a meeting. You know, and I was starting to kind of go to some meetings by myself at this point, and I would be off standing in the corner, you know, just waiting for the meeting to start. And this guy just came up and started talking to me, and he asked me, you know, just how I was doing and making some small talk. And he started talking to me about the doctor's opinion and some of the things that are in that chapter about, you know, the phenomenon of craving and the mental obsession. I had no idea what he was talking about at all. You know, I figured I'd ask him to be my sponsor. You know, why not? And we started working together. He made some suggestions to me that things that I now suggest to guys that I meet. One of the first suggestions he gave me was to get on my knees in the morning and ask God for the strength to stay sober. And I wasted no time at asking him why that was important, sharing with him why it probably wouldn't work. You know, it's really just a miracle that I'm sober at all, because I did everything wrong. Okay, everything. You know, they said no major changes in the first year. In my first year, I started a business, had a girlfriend who had less time sober than I did, bought a house. I did everything wrong, you know. But the only thing I think I did right was I maintained a level of willingness to proceed through the steps and just follow some direction. But this guy tried with me. You know, he gave me some suggestions, and I did follow that suggestion, you know. And, you know, he told me something like, well, if you don't think it's going to work, you know, that's fine. But is it going to make anything worse? Is it going to hurt? You know, and that idea, like, okay, yeah, I mean, what do I have to lose? And that's a good lesson for me, you know, especially early on, that I don't have to have it all figured out. I just have to do this stuff, you know. I don't need to know how God is working. I just need to ask Him for help, you know. And that was where it started, you know. I mean, I got here with a belief in God, you know. I mean, I feel like I should almost back up to say that, really that is what I am here to share with you, is that, in my own words, how I have developed a relationship with a God of my understanding who has saved me from alcoholism. You know, again, you know, I've got this spiritual malady, and that is my problem, is the spiritual deficit. And then, you know, I find alcohol, it becomes my solution until I lose the power of choice, and then I quit drinking. But that doesn't mean that I have solved the problem. I've just quit drinking. I'm still me. I'm still the same selfish, self-centered alcoholic, hurting everybody, stealing everything I can do, you know, I can get my hands on. And I'm doing all the same stuff. I'm just doing it sober now. You know, so I've got to find a power greater than myself that will help me with this spiritual problem that I've got. And that's why I need the 12 steps. You know, if all I had to do was quit drinking, I could just quit drinking and get out there and get to live in my life. But that hasn't been my experience, you know. So, you know, I found the sponsor. He starts giving me some suggestions, and he starts taking me through the steps. Yeah, that. You know, first suggestion to hit my knees in the morning, sure. But, you know, he told me to get a home group. You know, again, I mean, it's just funny. I think I asked him why about everything he told me to do. Why do I need to get a home group? And what's the point? You know, and why? But I just would do these things. And I became active in my home group. I got a home group, became active in it, started making coffee there. And I got there early, and I would set the chairs up while I was waiting for people to show up. And people would come in, and we would just hang out and talk, have some coffee. And I didn't know what was going on, but something was going on right there, you know. I mean, at that point, I maybe had a couple months sober. I hadn't really been through any of the action steps. All I was doing was getting on my knees in the morning, asking God to keep me sober, and following some directions, you know, some of the service work. But I'm staying sober, you know. So, I mean, really, you know, this is just this period of grace where I'm not really doing anything other than asking for help and connecting with some other alcoholics. And I'm having some profound experiences, you know. You know, all of a sudden I'm looking forward to going to my home group, you know. You know, eventually when they ask me out for coffee after the meeting, I go with them and we hang out. And I have one of my first experiences hanging out outside of an AA meeting where I hang out all night. I don't think about drinking once, you know, and lights are going on. Wow, okay. Something is happening here. Yeah, so he's taking me through the steps, and I guess I started to say this, that I did believe in God when I got here. You know, many of the guys that I've sponsored have some real issues with God, and that's understandable. But for me, it was, you know, I believed in God, and I really believed that God was a very loving being. You know, I didn't have a concept of God that he was a punishing, angry God. But, my only relationship to God was that when I was in real trouble, you know, I would throw out these foxhole prayers, you know, a lot of bargaining, you know, God, before I go to court tomorrow, please, just, you know, help me tomorrow, and I'll change, you know, I'll do anything you want me to do. And so I have this belief in God. I don't have a relationship with God. I don't understand how to trust God. I don't know how to rely on God. I don't have a relationship with him. I have a belief in him. I can go to the beach and go, wow, man, this is awesome. Look at what God has created, you know. But I don't know how to use God, you know. And so when this sponsor is taking me through the steps, I don't know it at first, but I'm learning how, you know. He has me do the third step prayer with him. And we get on our knees. We're holding hands, and it's really creepy at first. You know, I'm holding this guy's hands in his living room, saying some prayer out of a book. And just 3 months ago, I mean, I'm this other person. Like, what is happening? You know, and that's where I learned how to pray. Is from this book. You know, that third step prayer was one of the first ones that I said. And there's a guy in Richmond who used to pass out these cards with the third step prayer on one side, the seventh step prayer on the other side, and memorize it, you know. And so I did, and that became one of my first ways that I would be able to talk to God on a daily basis. But it also became clear to me that I could talk to God like I'm talking to you. You know, this is my God, you know. And that helped me to understand I could have a relationship with him. And much like a relationship with a friend, I've got to spend some time with him. You know, I can't have a relationship with somebody if I only call him when I need him. You know, I've got to hang out with God. I've got to spend some time with him, talk to him, ask him for help, tell him what's going on. And so I began to be able to communicate with my higher power this way. And, you know, I used to say things like, I don't know how to pray. Because I thought that prayer was, you know, Lord, thou art gracious and bold. And, yeah, I was like, I don't know how to do that, you know, so I could just talk to him. And that, it made a difference for me. And when I went through the fourth step with this sponsor, it was hardly searching. It was not fearless. It was not really thorough. It was just what I did at the time. You know, I had one resentment, and I had a couple fears, and I think I kind of glossed over my my sex inventory, and I shared it with him. I went on to 6 and 7, made a list of people that I'd harmed, and set out making some amends. And I did make some amends, you know. I made amends to my mom. You know, I made amends to the girlfriend that I had mentioned earlier, who I was still dating at the time. And close friends, people that I was hurting, I admitted to them, you know, the nature of my wrongs, and really tried to right those relationships where I could. Somewhere along that line, though, you know, I had been frantically managing my own life, you know, this whole time. You know, I had started this business. You know, I painted this picture that, you know, yeah, I am developing this relationship with God, which is true. However, I am still managing my own life, and I still have this idea of what a sober life looks like. I thought that, you know, because I get sober, now I'm able to get back to this life that I was unable to have. I'm going to be able to have the things that, you know, I was deprived, and I'll, you know, be able to hold a job and get a house and do all these things. And all that's very true, you know, but that's not my objective. And when I, at this point, when I first come in, it was. And I had been spending a lot of energy focusing on these things and not focusing on keeping my side of the street clean. You know, I had made some attempts to clean up the past. I'd gone through 1 through 9. You know, as non-thorough as it was, I had gone that far. And I'd been sober at this point for a couple of years. You know, I got into this place, which the book tells me is, you know, it's going to happen. You know, in step 10 it says we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, and when these crop up. So it tells you it's going to happen. And for me, you know, I got caught up in all kinds of self-pity. I was hanging on to resentments, and I was not doing the daily work that exists in step 10. And I, as a result, drifted away from this relationship with God and drifted real deep into self and self-pity, and as a result, a lot of misery. And, you know, I learned that I won't stay miserable real long in this program. You know, I'm either going to do some work or I'm going to go and drink. And in this case, I drank. I had about 3.5 years sober, and I was miserable. I mean, I was miserable. And I was going to a lot of meetings. You know, I was going to like 6-7 meetings a week, had a sponsor. But my relationship with my sponsor was just a game, you know. I call him, hey, how's it going? Oh, yeah, man, great. Things are good. Things are real good. All right. And that was it. And but anyway, so, you know, I drank. And it was just this experience where I drank one night, and after a couple beers, man, that sense of ease and comfort came over me again. It was just like, okay, well, those people in A are real nice, you know. I really like them a lot, but, you know, I'm probably, yeah, I'll keep in touch with them, see how they're doing from time to time. You know, I was figuring out my whole new life now as a drinker again. And I'll keep in mind all the stuff they said, but, yeah, it's just not for me. And you know, then all these thoughts would creep into my head while I was drinking. I was like, oh, yep, they told me about this too. Yeah, my drinking's going to be ruined. And I was like, I'm not going to let them ruin this night for me. You know, I'm going to enjoy this. And I had to just really try to not think about people I knew and meetings I'd been to, guys that I was currently sponsoring, my sponsor. I mean, I had to block all that out just so I could get some ease and comfort, you know. And surprisingly enough, I was able to do it. But what happened, though, was at the end of that night, you know, I had been in the habit of, before I go into bed, getting on my knees and thanking God for giving me the strength to stay sober. And I was going to bed. I would have told you that I stopped drinking, you know, because I was done drinking. But really, I was about to throw up, and I knew if I didn't stop drinking, I was going to get really sick. So I stopped drinking and then was getting ready to crawl into bed. And I got down on my knees out of habit, and then it just hit me that I couldn't, I just felt disconnected. You know, I was going to thank God for giving me the strength to stay sober, but I hadn't stayed sober, you know. And it really just scared me. It scared me bad, man. And I just had that feeling all of a sudden, like, what have I done? What, you know, what is going on? And I was in Ocracoke, down around the Outer Banks at the time when this happened. Had planned on being there for this weekend, and so I knew I needed to get out of there. And so I hopped in my truck, and the next morning, and started barreling back to Richmond, man, just freaked out. And I'm like, all right, nobody's going to know about that. That's going to be my little secret. You know, I got an anniversary coming up. I'm going to pick up that four-year chip and keep on moving. That'll be fine. And, you know, my phone rings, and it's my brother, and he's like, hey, man, how's it going? You know, and I was like, well, coming back. And he's like, yeah, really? Why? I was like, ah, it's just not having that much fun. And he's like, well, at least you didn't drink. And I was like, oh, crap. Yeah, well, I did. And I got honest with him. And it was just, it wasn't me, man. I just got honest with him. And I was like, actually, I did. And I just fell apart, you know. And he couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. It was just surreal, you know. How could this have happened? And, you know, so I came back. I stopped by my mom's house on the way home to Richmond. And I told her what was going on. And we had a very powerful experience, you know. My mom sat me down. I told her that I had drank again, and she just said, well, what do you want to do, you know? And I said, you know, I want to be sober again, you know. I had experienced enough of being sober to know that life, even as miserable at times as it was so much better than anything I'd had before. And, you know, my mom had relapsed in her story. She'd gotten about 15 years sober, relapsed. And she, I think, now has somewhere between 12 and 13 years. And she had a real hard time making sense of her relapse. And when we met that day and talked, not as mother and son, but talked as two alcoholics, sharing their experience, strength, and hope with the idea that somebody might get better, I think that she got some clarity on why she relapsed. Her experience became the most valuable thing that she could share with me. That she had done it too. She had gone back. You know, what do you want? Well, I want to get sober. Well, then just pick up where you left off and get going again. And very significant, powerful experience for me, because I just did, you know. And I had guys, you know, in the fellowship call me up and, you know, went back to Richmond, picked up a white chip, and I had people just like, blown away. Like, what are you talking about? You know, and but I had people calling me, telling me things like, you know what, you drank, big deal, you're an alcoholic, just get on with it, you know. And I needed to hear that kind of thing. I also needed to get a new sponsor, and I did. And my first sponsor, great guy, you know. But I needed to get active in this program in a way that I hadn't been before. And I got a new sponsor, and this was the first guy that really took me through the big book and helped me to understand some things about my disease. He helped me to understand some things about what I need to do to recover. And so we went through the steps together, you know. He helped me to understand what it truly is to be powerless over alcohol, you know, that I've lost the power of choice, you know. I cannot rely on my mind to keep me sober, you know. I had heard all kinds of things. Just don't drink. Just go to meetings, you know. Play the tape through, you know. Just you know, remember your last drunk so you don't pick up that first drink. But that's kind of the problem with me, is that you know, my disease centers mostly in my mind. You know, and my mind is the very thing that's going to tell me that actually a drink is a good idea. So I can't rely on the problem to be the solution, you know. And when I understand that, I really start to understand why I do need to have some kind of power greater than me. No human power could have relieved my alcoholism. People, humans tried, you know, but they weren't able to. People told me to quit drinking and prayed for me, and I don't know if that helped or not, but people wanted to relieve me of my alcoholism. No human power was able to do it, you know. And that this whole idea that my life had become unmanageable, I thought that that was, you know, the fact that I had been evicted. I thought that was, you know, the fact that, you know, I wrecked cars, went to jail, things like that. But what he helped me to understand was that my life is unmanageable by me alone. I mean, I can certainly manage my own life. I just do a very bad job at it, you know, because I'm selfish and self-centered, fearful. You know, when I go out into the world and make decisions based on self, I hurt people. I hurt me, you know. And when I truly understand these things, it just makes sense. That's why I need the rest of these steps, because I can't do it by myself, you know. And if I really believe that there is something out there more powerful than me that can do it, well, it's about time to make a decision to do it. And that was step three, you know. I mean, really, for me, that whole step three, making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand Him, I mean, simply, for me, it was just making a decision to do step four, you know. If I believe that there is a God out there that can relieve me of my alcoholism, well, I need to make a decision to let Him do it, you know. So I launch on a course of vigorous action, you know. I start this inventory, and that's where some stuff starts changing, you know. I list these resentments. You know, and I had really thought for a long time that it was just you people that were making me angry. And if I could get you people to change and act right, then I wouldn't have to be bothered with all the crap that I was feeling all the time. You know, you guys are really irritating sometimes, you know. What I found out, though, through that part of that inventory was, you know, I was prepared to look at the list from an entirely different angle. You know, where was I at fault? You know, and where I was at fault wasn't necessarily always in your behavior. You know, I mean, some of the problems, you know, they say fancied or real. Some of these things are real. You know, I had customers that owed me money, and I'd be resentful at them. Well, they owed me the money. You know, I didn't do anything wrong there. But where am I at fault? And that would throw me. Where am I at fault? I'm at fault for having some kind of selfish expectation that when they behave the same way I behave, that, you know, somehow they're different than me. You know, I could be resentful at you for owing me money while my credit cards are unpaid. You know, I'm doing the same thing, but I've got this selfish expectation that, you know, there's a different set of rules that apply to me. And when I start to understand that, you know, I really start to understand that to my core, you know, I'm selfish and self-centered, and I have a lot of expectations about how the world should behave, and when it doesn't behave the way I want it to, I get angry, you know? And when I get angry, I completely block myself off from the one thing that's going to save my life, you know? You know, and I share that with a sponsor in my fifth step. Well, you know, let me not skip, you know, the piece on listing my fears and understanding that I'm truly fearful just simply because I don't know how to trust God. I can't trust God and be fearful. The fear and trust just can't coexist. And my sexual inventory, good God, I mean, it needed an overhauling. Every relationship that I had with any woman was, again, based on pure selfishness, you know. I hurt a lot of people there, and I needed God to help me come up with a new ideal about what this part of my life was going to look like in the future. And, you know, so I share all this, and I illuminate every dark cranny of my past. And you know, there is promises after the fifth step that just have become so important to me. I did a fifth step with one of my sponsees yesterday, and it's just such a powerful experience to see see the light come on in someone else's eyes. You know, when he started to understand that he was the root of some of these problems, you know, but more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents a stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension. That makes for more drinking. I mean, it goes on, but you know, when I share my inventory with a sponsor, it's the first time I understand, you know, I get to experience not living this double life. You know, I've come clean with somebody who knows me, and I don't need to look around the corner, you know, as much, hoping that somebody hasn't seen what I've done and whatnot. You know, and then I take this hour after that fifth step and reflect on my work and try to connect again with God and make sure that what I've done so far is solid. And, you know, my first time through these steps, when I saw 6 and 7 in the book, there's just a couple short paragraphs. And I would often think, well, what's the deal? You know, why is there so little on 6 and 7? And it's only recently dawned on me that maybe it's because I'm not the one doing the work in step 6 and 7. You know, God's doing the work. You don't need a whole lot of instructions on 6 and 7. You know, all I need to do in 6 is look at 5 and understand, you know, yes, I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I can't change me. I need God's help. And I'm now ready to ask Him for some of that help. And I ask Him for that help in step 7. And in that prayer, you know, I ask God to remove the defects that stand in the way of my usefulness to you. Not the defects that get in my way, and not the defects that are irritating me, but the ones that get in the way of my usefulness to you. Because, you know, my problem is that I'm selfish. So my solution is to be selfless. So if I've got defects that are blocking me from you, that's a problem, you know. And so I say the 7-step prayer, and in the book it says, we have then completed step 7. And I happen to be in a phase of my recovery where I get real literal with the book, but when I look at that, that I've completed step 7, it tells me I'm done with step 7. And I go to step 8, and I start making a list of the people that I've harmed. And I don't want to get... Well, all right. So what I'm trying to do, step 9, if I don't truly understand the nature of my wrongs, if I don't truly understand how I've hurt you, I can't make amends. I can apologize, but I can't make amends if I don't really know how I've harmed you. And I turned in my 8th step to my sponsor to have him reject it 3 times. You know, no, come on, man. You know, you got more work to do here. And that was helpful for me and mildly irritating. But but when I clean up, when I start going back and making amends for this damage that's done, that is when all of a sudden I can walk a free man. Because I don't need to be afraid that someone's going to come around that corner and I might need to duck them, you know. There's promises all throughout this book, and a lot of meetings share the 9-step promises, and they're profound. But I often thought that there were promises that were going to happen on the outside of me. And there are promises that happen on the inside. You know, it's a lot of fears falling away and things that happen on the inside of me. I could talk all night about step 9, but step 10 has been something that has become extremely important to me. You know, I mentioned that I finished 7, but that is true to me if I'm doing 10 as it says in the book, because in step 10 it says I continue to watch. So I'm continuing to take inventory, which is like very much like step 4. I'm continuing to watch for the same defects that I found on my 4-step inventory: selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And when these crop up, I ask God at once to remove them, which is very much like step 7. So I'm not continuing to do 7. I'm just doing 10. But I ask God at once to remove them. And when I've harmed somebody, I make amends quickly, which is like 8 and 9, you know. And then I resolutely turn my thoughts to somebody that I can help. That enables me to try and keep things clean. You know, I spend a lot of time cleaning up things in knot 1 through 9, and 10 helps me to keep it clean, keep connected with God, keep connected with you, and then step 11 is just, my job here is to seek God. You know, I've got to seek Him. People say things like, you know, we don't find. I won't get off into that, but I mean, my job is to seek God. You know, through prayer and meditation. And my concept of meditation was more of like an Eastern view of meditating with the incense and all that, and that's great, love it. But when this book was written, the word meditate, I was told, means more to actually consciously think of something, you know, and it didn't make sense that there's almost this daily inventory in 11 that I, in my wisdom, thought should have been somewhere around 10. But I'm meditating about my day. I'm asking God for direction throughout my day. I'm reviewing my day at night constructively so I don't drift into morbid reflection, because that would diminish my usefulness to you. Got to have God's help, you know, with this thing. And that's how I try to live my day. You know, when I wake up, I ask God to direct my thinking, you know, especially this divorce from self-pity, dishonesty, and self-centeredness. And I do 12 in a lot of ways, mostly by sponsoring guys. And, you know, I'm getting really close. Well, I guess I'm over. But I just can't say enough about this program. I truly love it, and it's a true honor and privilege for me to be able to come here and share. And I just want to thank you again for listening and asking me to speak.